Annexation number 1193, 8, Rule 27.
Eyston, Reel 27. Was your mail censored at all, Mr. Eyston?
Oh, yes, rigorously censored. And that was the main reason for these letter cards coming in. Because that did away with any censor. You could just put the numbers down and the message was already written. So there was no need for that to be censored. It was already approved on the letter, on the form. So that was no need for censor on that, did away with that bit. But the rest were all heavily censored. And I did get one or two letters back saying that there was black marks on it where they couldn't, not a lot, but there was occasionally things which they hadn't quite agreed with, and they put a blue pencil through it. It was a black pencil, I believe, actually, a thick crayon type of thing, and it just blotted everything out. I suppose in a pinch you could really find an imprint on it if you'd gone that far, but it was blacked out. And it was censored. Every letter was censored. And some of the officers used to complain bitterly that it was like a jankers for them. It was a task which they didn't want and one they didn't like, because it took a lot of time up. And well, it was, to them it was a waste of time in a sense. But it was something that they had to be doing. As I said, it was like a defaultness to them. They were, if something hadn't gone quite right, they were given this task of going through the mail. And I suppose it is possible that if one of them was a little bit bitter, he could have scored out more than need have been scored out. On the other hand, if he was in a good mood with himself, those things went through and should never have gone through. All the same, they were censored. And generally it fell to a junior officer, a second lieutenant, to do this. No doubt, I would think, if there was something they weren't sure about, they would take it to a senior officer and get it put right. But certainly there was a strict censorship all the way through. Right from leaving England, there was strict censorship. Even on the boat, it was all censored. So, yes, the censorship was severe. Just one other thing about Sidi Bish that comes to mind. We're having a really good time, but I developed a very severe toothache. So it got so bad that eventually I went to a Greek dentist. And it cost £1.50 to get a tooth out. That today sounds very, very cheap. But in those days, it was quite a lot of money. However, it was really obliging. And his daughter brought tea in, and then she spent about half an hour with me after the tooth was out. And it was, it was quite a treat. And, of course, I got relief. It was still sore for a while, but I got relief. Then was a terrific amount of money I've been paying for to have one tooth extracted, especially when I could have done for nothing in the dentist. However, I had so much pain that it had to go. Teeth were never doctored in those days. They went.
There's no dental service in the box.
We never saw it, quite honestly. I suppose you went to the MO and he would direct you back to some place where there was a dental surgeon. I suppose the field ambulance had a dentist with them, and that was run by a brigade. We did have ambulance men with us. We had our own MO, and he had the stretcher bearers, which were the band who were stretcher bearers. And then we had maybe two ambulances in the box under direct control of the battalion. And they would go back to the field ambulance, which was 149 field ambulance. That's something I've never fathomed out, that we were 151 brigade, we had 149 field ambulance. 149 used to be in the 50 division, but that went, but we, 151 brigade, returned 149 field ambulance. Never quite fathomed that one. I suppose there was dentists there. I never went to see, quite honestly.
Were there not regular health inspections in the box, or did you just report sick when you felt sick, and if you didn't, you never saw the MO?
The only thing regular were injections. They used to come along periodically, top-ups. Before we left England, we had a series of injections of various things. Even before we went to France, we'd started on this thing. And they had to be topped up every so often. Nearly all of them had to be topped up. And one of them, I remember, was a very bad one. It was a TAB, TT, and something else. There was three injections in one, which was a cocktail, as they called it. That was really naughty. It was nasty for two or three days. But that was really the only time that we saw the MO, unless we wanted to see him for some reason. And the only reason really you wanted to see him was desert sores. Well, really, you didn't have to see the MO for desert sores, because if you went and saw the enemy's orderlies, and with the band, I was quite friendly with the sergeant and two of the corporals through the dance band. So normally I just went and saw one of them if I wanted some ointment for the desert sore, which fortunately I didn't have a lot of trouble with desert sores. There was later on, much later on, after Alamein and on the way up towards Benghazi, I developed a carbuncle right on the hip joint. And it was right where my hip touched the seat when I was driving. Oh, and I had a terrible 3 days with this thing. Eventually, one night I pulled in about, I think it was 11:30, and I went and saw the MO, and he gave me some stuff to put me out, and he put me out for the night. It meant I couldn't do any work that night. And by the next morning, it had worn off, and I think he'd lanced it, but I could never be sure. And anyway, it eased off after that, and I carried on driving. I had to go and see him for about 3 or 4 days. Every time I got in, no matter about sick prayer or anything like that, every time that I got in, I had to go and see him. I was very friendly with the MO as well. He's had a remarkable time, quite honestly. I think it was Joy, David Joy, I think it was, at that time.
What was the role of the Padre, and how did he carry that out in the box? Was there a regular church service?
No. Congregations weren't allowed. Any assembly wasn't allowed. We ate in our own. We used to go up to the cookhouse and get our food and go back to our dugouts and have a meal in the dugout. Congregations weren't allowed. They didn't like. I think it was 6 people at the cookhouse at one time. Mind you, had probably 3 or 4 cooks, so that meant 10. When it used to get up towards the dozen, 15, maybe 20. And if it got to 20, there was a roar from somebody and get away from there kind of thing. So congregations weren't allowed, but he used to have a little communion service on his own sort of thing. Well, not on his own, but he would go to a place, to the company headquarters maybe, and have a communion service. In one place in S Company, I know they used to go in the officers' mess and have this service, because that was well dug in. And there he was allowed to have a few more people. You see, the cookhouse was outside, which meant that people were exposed. Whereas when he were in the officers' mess or the sergeant's mess or any place that was dug in, that wasn't exposed, and you could assemble maybe 20 people there. But assemblies weren't encouraged at all. In fact, they were really discouraged. So there was no church service as a service, but the father used to have his little chats, and he'd come round and visit everybody as often as possible. In fact, the Tommy Bath that I mentioned, he was the party's driver. So I knew pretty well what the party's up to. He knew me and through Tommy.
Do you remember his name?
I can't, no. I know we started off with Spurler, but I think we dropped him after France. And I can't just recall the padre. No.
Can we come to looking at the support that you had? In
Can I just mention that on the way back from Sidi Bish, we passed through El Alamein. Never realising what El Alamein was going to be in the future. But we passed through a lot of places on the way back, because you went so far up the desert road, up the main road, the coast road, and then went into the desert. So we went through quite a few places, but we never sort of realised when we saw El Alamein and what it was going to mean in future days. There's also a very, very big field park there, and I can't just remember the name of it. That was just as you're going into the desert out of Alex. I can't remember the name for it. But I had to go back there two or three times on later occasions to draw extra vehicles. I don't know why I can't remember that name, but it was a massive place. Just off the coast road, and I had to go back there, as I said, on a few occasions to draw extra vehicles and carriers, and I went down there once to get a load of anti-tank guns, two-part anti-tank guns in the Portees, and then it was on the desert. Now, by the time we got back in the box, we were as mucky and filthy as we were when we left, on account of the sand that was blowing up on the back of the wagon. So really, by the time we got back to Ghazala, we were just as mucky, and all we had left for the 4 days in Sidi Bish were memories. We were just back in the same state, in the same condition. To get to the people who were in the box with us, I did say that the South Africans were in El Alamein and going down, and then there was 151 Brigade, which was the 9th Battalion on our right, next to the 1st South African people, 6th Battalion in the centre, and the 8th Battalion on the left. And about a mile further down, there was 69 Brigade. And in the box with us, there was, under Brigade control, with the 74th Field Artillery, with 25 pounders, I think that was 12... I think it was 12, 25 pounds. I'm not too certain about what a regiment is. The troop's 4, and I think it's 3 troops of the regiment. Anyway, I think about 12, but anyway, a field regiment. And the 505 Field Company REs, which were the people who lifted mines, as I said later on, they came and dug truck pits, weapon pits, and so forth. There, I believe, no, it was our pioneers that erected the toilets. Mainly they were on mine, laying minefields and clearing gaps in the mines if we wanted to be through them. And they also went out with the jock columns in case we hit a minefield on patrol and they had to get a patrol through a minefield. So they went out there, quite a hazardous time, these lads. There's a detachment of REs with every jock column that went out, and if we got to enemy lines, and most of the caper was to go through the minefield into the enemy lines and bring some prisoners back so that they could be interrogated. That was the main purpose of most of our patrols. And then there was A Company of the 2nd Treasury Regiment. They were a machine gun regiment. And again, if a column went out, there was a section of machine guns went. I'll be describing the box later on. And there was a battery of 65 anti-tank regiment, the Norfolk Yeomanry. They, at that time, were equipped with 6-pounders. The battalion was equipped with 2-pounders then, 2-pound anti-tank guns on Portees. The Norfolk Yeomanry had 6-pounders on Portees. There was a battery of the 25th Lacac Regiment with Beaufort guns, and they were in Thumberland Yeomanry, or the Thumberland Hussars, the Yeomanry and Hussars. They're they're the same people. And then there was B Company 149 Field Ambulance. And there were one or two more signalers. I think it was a full section of signalers, I believe. I think there was a brigade signaler, sort of a signal corps man in each battalion. Or maybe two. No, I think it was two. Two signalers from brigade, signal corps in each battalion, and then brigade would have their own signalers which deciphered messages and encoded messages and deciphered them and transmitted them.
Did you get close to these people? Did they become part of a very integral part of your unit?
Oh, yes. Just like the Remy people had joined us, they became part of it, yes. And I did mention before about the yeomanry. They never wasted a shell, but when we got the poles, I mean, they flashed everything away. And we had a great regard for the Northumberland yeomanry, more so than the Norfolk yeomanry, I think, because obviously they were North Country people. And we took a great regard to them. Now, I'm a bit lost about them, because mainly the Northumberland yeomanry, like the Norfolk yeomanry, were anti-tank gunners. But they must have had one company, which was our hat, because certainly it was Northumberland Hussars who were with the Beaufors. There were a number of other people who came in with us. I can't just recall them at the moment, but there was odds and ends all the way coming through who joined the box. And they all had their own command, but they were all under battalion... they were split, so many came under battalion control, but they were all under brigade control, actually. There was also, way out the back, it was the 44th Royal Tank Regiment, who were under 50 divisional control, but that was division, not brigade. And we all settled down. I mean, the ACAC men had their guns to look after, and they did quite a lot of work. The anti-tank gunners were spaced out all the way down the desert, all the way down the box on the perimeter, in case we were heavily attacked by armoured units. Our own anti-tank was into space with them. But when the column went out, if it was a big column, there would be a detachment of the ACAC, a detachment of the Norfolk Yeomanry with their 6-pounders, a detachment of our own 2-pounders, a detachment from the REs to lift the mines and make gaps, possibly one ambulance, not always, we didn't always take an ambulance, because generally if it was a bad case we'd whip them in the truck and send them back, but there's always somebody quite handy to take them back to the ambulance. And we all settled down with our own little job to do.
Can we turn to Jock Collins, Mr. Heiston? Do you recall either your first or any particular column which has a clear in your memory that you could describe and take me through?
Well, there were so many and so varied. You see, a column was sent out by division with a job to do. Now, normally, there was a column out from the brigade all the time. Like 69 Brigade would send one week, 151 would send one the next week, and 150 the next week. And we're talking about the 30-mile no man's land. The column went out and settled maybe 2 miles away or maybe 1,000 yards away from the enemy lines, enemy mines. And there would send patrols out. If we were 2 miles away, obviously they went out by truck so far until they got within sound distance. And then they would go on foot from there, and the carriers would go out with them and do that. Now, the formation of a company column would be... there would be a company, and normally the column would come under the command of that company commander, who was generally a major. There'd be a section of carriers, normally 2 carriers and a mortar carrier, sort of on the right hand forward, and the same again on the left hand forward. And behind that would be the navigating officer. Now, this I could never understand. All the canopies were taken off every vehicle. To make them lower down. We very often left the bars on, and just took the cameras off, because the bars weren't easy to see. You could hide a vehicle with the bars sticking up, but if you had the canopy on, it made an object. So the canopies were taken off all the vehicles and tucked into the vehicle itself. But the navigating officer, they put black and white boards all the way around him, and a flag on the top, which made him stand out. All righty. It was good for us because we could see, we knew where the navigating officer was, and we knew our position in relation to the navigating officer. But having made all the camouflage things that we could possibly do, like camouflage nets all the way around, we go and decorate this one up and put a flag on the top, and at night he has a red light shining to the rear. Well, he's only got to go so far, halfway around, the red light's shining over the enemy lines. This I could never understand why they dolled him up like this. But behind the two sections of carriers, six carriers, was the navigating officer. And then, normally, there would be a troop of 25-pounders, four guns, with their quads, which pulled them along. And down the side, one side would have a troop of anti-tank guns. The other side would have a troop of Bofa guns. Inside the three sections of the square, there would be the three infantry platoons. And in the middle, you would have the company headquarters and the administration people. And along the back side, there would be the section of machine gunners mounted on trucks so that they could fly through any direction and they were in action straight away, could be. And that's how it went out. Through the day, travelling through the day, it would be 100, 220 yards apart. And we'd lager up for the day in open formation. At dusk, we would move to the position that we were going to attack during the night, or as close as reasonably possible. And then we'll close into 60 yards between vehicles. So the square was dragged in all ways around. And the 25 pounds would take a corner post each. And the anti-tank guns would take a flank each. You know, four guns, one in each flank. And the Bofa guns would come in, would do the same. So you might have a 25-pounder and a Bofa and an anti-tank and a 25-pounder on the other corner, on the outside. The carriers, very often, they went outside, or at night, if there was two sections of carriers, so many would come in to get a rest, and the others would be out on patrol and seeing what they could do. Very often the carriers were out there to do a night shoot. They were going out to shoot somebody up, and that's so they were out most nights. And again, the infantry, maybe a platoon would go out one night, and another platoon the next night, or maybe only a section would go out, depending what the job, what the task was. And as I said, the tasks were laid down by division. There was no digging, apart from through the day when we sort of withdrew a bit. You could take your spade out and a lump of paper if that was a thing that you had to do. We didn't dig any slip trenches at all. And I said that very often that I was a collector of sheets at night if I wasn't out with anybody. We would lay a sheet on the sand, on the desert, and climb in with our greatcoats on, and then drag another sheet over the top of us, so that there's about 10 of us in the one spot, which was strictly illegal if being caught. There'd be about 10 of us under the one sheet, and keeping ourselves warm and having a good sleep. Of course, any sound, when you're out in these situations, you're wide awake, no matter what the sound is. It might be somebody snoring, or even a tin rattling. Could be a plane going over miles away, But you can hear on the desert, funny enough, if it's a reasonable, if there's not a lot of wind, you can hear planes that are miles and miles away. It could be the lads going out to patrol or somebody coming back.
Did this play quite heavily on your nerves?
You don't notice it at the time. I think later on, when I did a number of columns, just before the collapse of the line, I did about 6 weeks, because then we started doubling up on columns. And in fact, we joined up with the 8th Battalion. Freddie Cole, the commander of the carriers, and the 8th Battalion joined up, and we did quite a few shoot-ups, because they were trying to get the soft skin stuff round to reinforce the armour which had gone round from round the bottom of the city of Bir Hakeim. And there was a lot of soft skin stuff going around to take petrol through and ammunition, extra troops and all that sort. And we were going out and have real good shoot-ups with these people until Roma got wise of it, and then he started bringing armour back on a night so they could have the armour escort the things through.
So you were in the desert, and as you're saying, that the noise has carried so much. Do you recall any particular incident in which you yourself were involved? What kind of thing were you doing? What was your particular role?
Well, we're talking about noise, which I think this is probably a good time to begin. It was quite late on in the life of the desert, actually. It was when we were doing these double sessions. And we're out one day. I've missed a little bit. I think I did mention it last time, but I'd maybe better just bring it back again. We had a listening post, which was known as the ambulance post. And that was a mile in front of our minefield. And there was a small platoon, not a full platoon, but a small platoon, went out into that listening post. It was quite well dug, and they couldn't be seen. And unless they fired something, people could go past them. And they would send information in that somebody's coming past and not sure who it is or something like that. And can the armoured cars come down and have a look and see who it is, or can the carriers look out? And so this listening post went out every morning, and it came back the following morning. And when it went out, there's a troop of carriers went out, a section of carriers. And it was called the ATAP, APAT. It was a section of carriers and a detachment of mortar, a troop of anti-tank guns that were on 2-pounders, and the outpost platoon that went to the ambulance post. And they would go out every morning and patrol up and down. I did say about the two ridges that were away in front, which are about 13, 12 miles from our minefield. So they used to go out, drop the listening post platoon off, and then the carriers and their APAT would follow on and go and patrol up and down these minefields to see what was happening. And they would meet the armoured cars, the South African armoured cars, which I mentioned, and they would have a little shoot up every now and again and see if they could find a prisoner or two. So they went out every day, and that's apart from the columns which went out. Occasionally I'd have to go out with the APAT, because if there were any tanks that sort of come out and maybe got blowed up in no man's land, we used to go out, take their they had air-cooled machine guns, Hotchkiss, very fast. Loads of ammunition we had, this type for the Hotchkiss. And we used to go out and take the guns out of the tanks, if they'd been brewed up, but not too badly. And we were always looking for the black bread. On the side of the tank, they had a box which carried the rations. And if we catch the black bread, we would bring that in, because that was like a malt loaf. It was really strange when you thought of our bread was all dust. So I used to go out with the APAT quite a bit to get guns or anything we could get hold of, quite honestly. often the tanks weren't worth bringing back because they were... later on, towards the end of the thing, when we were going out regular, we went out with a column and a section of the carriers were outside and sat down, you know, just watching. And an ITI Christie tank came out to have a look at them, see what was going on. So the carriers, they swiftly got in behind the tank and started shooting. They only had Bren guns. And they started lacing into the Christie tank with the Bren guns. And the tank stopped, and they got out and gave themselves up. Much to the surprise of the carriers. So the carrier sent the crew back into the column,